Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas. This week, I'm joined by Orlando Gibbs, who's recently completed a doctorate in Plautus, the Roman comic playwright, and notably wrote a fantastic piece a few years ago for the classics website, the open source classics website, Antigone. Do check it out. It's a wonderful resource for anyone interested in the classical world. And this piece was on what the Romans found funny. And it was such a wonderful piece of writing. The link is in the description for the podcast, but I wanted to get him on to elaborate more on that. What did the Romans find funny? Orlando is also a practitioner. He is just about to start a run in the West End in the musical Back to the Future. So he's also going to discuss a little bit about his experiences of moving from classics into the theatrical world, from thinking about theatre to actually doing it. Welcome to the podcast, Orlando.
Thanks very much.
So, Orlando, what's the best source that we have for Roman comedy? What's the best evidence for what the Romans actually found funny?
Well, it's tricky to kind of delineate what Roman comedy really means. The most amount of evidence that we have for any kind of comedic output, whatever that means, is these very interesting plays, the fabulae palliatae, the plays in Greek dress is what palliatae means. And they're essentially quite small-scale narrative plays that are mostly based on Greek original comedies. And these Greek comedies date from the kind of the 4th to the 3rd century BC. I think you could classify them as funny. You could. Lots of people think of them more as like character studies. Small-scale stories that sort of anticipate modern sitcoms in terms of their scale, in terms of their characterization, in terms of the kind of stock tropes and types that they are using. But I think there is a recognisable sense of what we would classify as a comic play in these plays. And Plautus, the author that I would claim to at least know a bit about, is the author for whom we have the most text surviving from antiquity. 20 and a bit of his plays survive, thanks to the transmission, the manuscript tradition via the Carolingian period and the medieval period. We have another author who came after him as well called Terence, six of whose plays survive. And it's thought that that's most of what he put together. There's no way of knowing. And indeed, he died very young. Terence died when he was sort of like 25, and it's thought that he died on a voyage to Greece to go and find more scripts to adapt into Latin, because the well has sort of run dry by that point. But Plautus is definitely the author who the tradition covers in the most depth.
Terence died for the funny.
Terence did die for the funny. But what's very interesting scripts about Terence's plays is the character of them really differs from the Plautine corpus. And in terms of, if we're thinking about what Romans found funny, kind of the stereotype is that the Plautine plays are the more sort of rollicking, farcical, fun ones that give us a clearer insight into one of the, shall we say, aesthetics that Romans found, quote-unquote, funny. I'm sort of hedging my bets about what we're defining as comedy, because while the Plautine plays do refer to themselves as komoidiae, which is a very interesting word in and of itself, because it is taken from Greek, obviously komoidia is how Greek theatrical practitioners refer to comedies. But to my knowledge, there's no moment in any surviving Greek play where they are referred to as komoidiae. I'm sure I could be disagreed with on that. Maybe there are bits of Aristophanes that refer to them as komoidiae, but it's certainly very strange for a Roman play to refer to it in a term that is so fraught with kind of Greek literary aesthetics.
Yeah, because I think when you talk about what people find funny, it brings up the further question of what kind of thing do you think comedy is?
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to work out. It's a bit like asking what courage means.
It's a sort of existential
quality as well, as something that can be applied in real time. And laughter obviously feels really personal and conditioned by the era you're in. I've been reading a bit of Rabelais recently, who's seen as a great comic genius, and you know, his Gargantua and Pantagruel, these kinds of Renaissance escapades. And for years I've been told Rabelaisian is brilliantly funny, and I've been reading it and I'm like, is it though? I mean, you know, you have to almost do a lot of legwork before you start finding it amusing. You know, there's objects of satire that you can only really understand if you know quite a lot about the late medieval world and Renaissance culture. So what do you think, with that in mind, about what brings out laughter, maybe, in Roman comedies? What do you think is actually universal about The structure of comedy.
Well, certainly the sort of more overarching structures of comedy that Roman literature really inherits from the Greek tradition is this idea that you have a problem that needs sorting. This is, broadly speaking, how Aristophanic plays work. There's like a big problem that one person comes up with an outlandish solution for, and then they pursue that in solution in what's known as the kind of desis of the plot, this idea that that's where all the complications of the narrative come. And usually they are complications that escalate and escalate in intensity, and usually in how outrageous they are, until eventually there is some kind of great crisis point, and then there is a leusis, there is a resolution. That's what the word leusis means. And with Aristophanes, a lot of these problems are like really huge scale. They're, you know, problems of what do we do with Athens? How do we solve the problems that are ailing the democracy? You know, in the Frogs, you know, the great problem is how do we save Athens at the end of the Peloponnesian War, and Dionysus and Xanthias go to the underworld to go and sort that out. And their journey to the underworld, you could classify as the desis, and then the leusis is like having... The solution that Dionysus comes up with is they need one of either Aeschylus or Euripides to come back.
Right.
And then there's a kind of poetic contest between the two, and Aeschylus wins. So like you can kind of see the sort of the journey through a kind of silly problem.
Yeah.
Or rather, the journey through a serious problem with a silly solution.
Yeah.
And the new comedy is what kind of comes after Aristophanes in Greek comedy. The new comedy restricts its scale in terms of geography, and in terms of the seriousness of the problems that are faced a lot. They tend to be quite domestic issues. They tend to be issues, you know, surrounding kind of boy meets girl, boy wants girl, boy can't have girl, for all and sundry of reasons that we would probably not classify as that funny.
Right,
so a lot of the problems in Greek New Comedy are usually the result of some kind of test of citizenship on the part of the girl. There is often a rape of some kind involved, and usually it's an unwitting rape where the young man gets drunk at a festival and sees a girl that he likes, rapes her, and then finds out that she, you know, is of citizen birth, or that she is someone that he's known, you know, for a while and has been betrothed to anyway. The solution to that problem, again, is what we would feel really hesitant, well, justifiably hesitant about, I think, and that really does not chime with what we would classify as comedic now, which is that the solution to these rape plots is that a marriage will just sort it out. So that feels very alien to us. And a lot of these plots are picked up in Roman comedies. There are such plays by Plautus. Terence's The Eunuch, which was his most successful play, partly because it was reported to be the most Plautine in its kind of language and its in the kind of jokes it actually has in it. That is also a rape plot. So like that sort of thing is obviously very different to what we would find funny.
Yeah.
And in terms of how the comedies are structured and what they are, what they're doing, I suppose a large part of what is universal about it is this idea of minor absurdities in stock characters being magnified.
Yeah.
I would find it very hard to, not least because it's not really what my expertise are in, I would find it hard to kind of say categorically how things like, difficult things like rape were received by the audiences. But on a purely like granular level, things like one-liners, you can kind of see why the structure of where these sentences are written is funny. There is often a structure of joke that is often used. It's what we would recognise as a joke, a sentence that is a bit perplexing or a bit confusing,
and then resolves.
And then a kind of
resolution.
In an unexpected
way.
Yeah, often. In an unexpected way.
I kind of wanted you to talk about Roman comedy because we all have a mental picture of what Greek comedy looked like. It's Aristophanes, it's the theatre festivals, it's men walking around with permanent erections, the sex strike in Lysistrata. There's lots of stuff which we associate the Greeks with that points us towards things that we call comedy, whether or not that they chime with what we would find funny. But the Romans, in a popular perception, you have to fast forward 2,000 years to Monty Python and The Life of Brian, which has Romans making jokes, you know, Biggest Dickus, etc.
Yes, yeah.
And that is a very funny... Maybe there's something we find intrinsically funny about Romans making jokes because we associate them so much with stern characters like Caesar ordering his troops into Gaul or Cato stabbing himself.
Yeah.
And actually, just to come back to Rabelais, who I think is interesting in this way because he makes fun of a lot of Greek and Roman culture.
Mm.
He makes fun of the kind of Caesarian narrative.
Yeah.
So he kind of transplants it into these grotesque situations where it's, you know, giants arguing about eschatology.
Yes. Yeah.
And Caesar, you know, any schoolboy of the Renaissance would have noticed what he was doing there. They'd have remembered their set text of Caesar going to Gaul. I just want you to give a picture of what the actual setting of Roman comedy was. The idea of a Roman laughing, to me, is just intrinsically quite funny.
The notion of the Romans as jokers is not a kind of popular perception, for sure. It's no coincidence that the sort of floruit of this kind of comedic product, I'll leave aside things like written satire and comic elements of other things like, you know, novels, for example. If we're just thinking about these staged plays, it's no surprise to me that their floruit is at a time where Roman imperialism is basically in full throttle.
Right.
Our first stories about these kind of plays being put on start in 240 BC with an ex-slave from Tarentum, which is in southern Italy, called Livius Andronicus. And he supposedly is the first person to take a Greek literary product, like a Greek play, and put it into Latin and have it have an argumentum, have it have a plot. So prior to him, a lot of the kind of Roman, shall we say, comedic entertainment, we would probably classify it as basically, you know, very, very loose and messy sketch comedy is probably what we classify it as. It's young men hurling kind of abusive verses at each other with little to no storage, and they tend to be like very short, farcical products, so-called native Italian entertainment. It's all a bit rough and ready. The evidence that we have for it is very scant, because the only time that we have evidence for so-called Italian farces is a couple of hundred years later when it becomes kind of codified in a literary tradition. So we can kind of get a sense of what the plots might have been. And they do actually match up fairly analogously with what is going on in Greek New Comedy in terms of stock types and everything. So what is interesting about Plautus is you can see flickers of this fusion of a Greek comic literary product with the Italian literary product. I mean, to be honest with you, a lot of what we would recognise as quite chauvinistic humour nowadays.
Yeah.
You think about how people talk about like stand-up in the 70s, you know, it's all like, take my wife, please, that sort of thing. That kind of very misogynistic sense of humour is definitely playing out through a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
The levity with which sexual abuse is treated, it makes it fairly uncomfortable to work with, even though what I have worked on hasn't actually featured that much.
Yeah.
All the stuff about sex work as well, it's quite an interesting thing to wrestle with, but it's not very funny.
It's a short step from saying stuff is universal to saying stuff is drearily predictable.
Yes,
and I guess there are just things that come back.
Yeah.
And I guess, could you sort of take us through some of those stock characters that the Romans...
Sure. Like, so a lot of them start off in Greek comedy and in Greek literature. I mean, a lot of the parasites that we encounter, that is a stock character that kind of reaches the zenith in Plautus and Terence for sure. The parasite and the clever slave...
So the parasite is...
The parasite is what we would classify, how would we understand a parasite. A free person who is very much dependent on the largesse and disposable income of someone with more status.
A moocher.
A moocher, yeah.
A beaver in a handful of dust or something like that.
Yeah. And someone who is always looking for a meal. And
sorry, I'm laughing. That sounds funny.
Yeah. And to be fair, you know, a lot of what I think is universal and transferable is the less culturally dependent stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there are still moochers nowadays. There are still scroungers. The parasite is to be delineated very sharply from the clever slave, because obviously the clever slave is enslaved.
Yeah.
And a lot of what Plautus does, that people and are about how original this is, I happen to think that the volume that he turns the dial up on this in terms of making the clever slave such a prominent character in his trickster plays, I think that is a sort of genuinely original feature. Tricksters do obviously feature in Greek comedy and in Greek literature. What I'm coming around to say is basically the parasite and the clever slave definitely have their literary heritage going back ultimately to Odysseus.
Yeah.
Obviously Odysseus is a king, so there is that level of discrepancy. But fundamentally, for kind of a comic product or a comedic product, the idea of someone with very low social status or no social status in the case of a slave, having their moment in the sun and subverting the power of someone who is much higher than them, that gets the Romans going.
And they would have easily read that into, say, in the Odyssey, where Odysseus himself has switches in status,
yes,
is pretending to be different social roles within that kind of earlier world.
Yeah.
And there are those moocher characters.
It's definitely.
Suitors are...
So the suitors are, you know, the moochers supreme.
Yeah.
And indeed, Odysseus, when he is a beggar, he is treated as an enslaved person. The way that he's described is that he's in the rags of a slave.
Yeah.
And when it comes to parasites, they're simultaneously held up for ridicule, okay. but also they are categorized as jokesters in themselves, as people who tell jokes in order to secure a meal. So
right.
Plautus's two most famous parasites, there's a character in the Persa, which means the Persian woman, the parasite there is called Sarturio, whose name literally means sort of full, which is ironic for someone who's always looking for a meal. His other parasite in the Stichus is called Gelasimus, funny man.
Right. Okay.
So again, and Gelasimus has various monologues where he says, look at my joke book, I've brought my jokes with me to tell. Okay. But Gelasimus is richly told, no, you can't come to dinner, there's no space for you.
Well, I guess that the role reversal thing, the playfulness with roles, you know, Jeeves and Wooster, the clever chap who's actually running the show,
who's
constantly manipulating the aristocratic, easy breezy character. I mean, once you get started, you can see maybe that's role reversal thing.
And such an easy breezy, overly emotional, romanticizing thicko is definitely another stock character, the Adolescens Amans. And again, what's so interesting about this is that these are the heritage of these characters definitely does come from Greek comedy. In Greek New Comedy, you know, the Neanias, the young man who's always in love. And hasn't always committed some sort of sexual misdemeanor. Sometimes the young men generally are debarred from the object of their affection by other obstacles. There's, you know, a money-grabbing pimp in the way. There's a sort of swaggering soldier. Those are two other stock characters that definitely are related to Greek comedy. The pimp, known as the Pornoboskos. And then the soldier is just referred to as the Stratiotes or whatever. The soldier himself, you know, does extend back to characters in the Odyssey who kind of believe in their own military might. There are generals in Aristophanes who are sort of pompous and are laid low, but they really crystallize in the Greek New Comic output, and then they get further refinement in the Roman comic output.
And I guess some of the difficult material we talked about earlier, some of that the rape narratives, for example, that is, I guess, it's all about power. And
it is. And that's also not to say that the plays uniformly go, haha, what a fool. I mean, don't get me wrong, they do say such, you know, young men do this sort of thing when they're drunk.
Right.
But it's not reading them, you don't get the sense that that's playing for laughs, a phrase that we would describe. One way in which Plautus is quite helpful is that it's very, very clear when something is intended to be farcical.
Right.
Or something is intended to be gaggy.
Okay.
You probably have noticed that when you watch, I don't know, a sitcom or a film that's, you know, billed itself as a comedy, there's this uneasiness that you feel when it becomes clear that basically people are actually not really playing characters, but they're just being people speaking gaggy lines.
Well, Succession had this problem.
Right.
I really, as it progressed, it became less of a programme about, I thought, about the super rich and about the tragedy of these people's situation, and more a kind of sitcom, which was about the situation.
Mm.
And I think it lost a lot of its power.
Yeah,
because there was this tension at the heart of it where they want to be funny, and the writers are brilliantly skilled at comic narratives, have immense experience at doing it. But it was always a kind of created tension, which eventually it was like the comedy won, I thought, in the
end. That's really interesting.
Especially in that last series.
Yeah. It's taking Plautus as a kind of, I suppose, a bank of evidence for what they might have found amusing. It does seem as though this kind of like not really caring that much about the narrative and just letting the individual scene or the individual moment be the thing that you're chasing, the thing that's going to get the quickest laugh. It's, you know, it's very easy to sort of read the Romans in our own image in that way. But it does seem to me that it's possible at least to connect on a basic human level about roughly what might... I'm aware I'm kind of having my cake and eating it too there, but you can kind of get a sense of how these just sort of either bits of slapstick or actually genuinely just like farcical kind of over verbose characters or these moments where they appear to just be doing one-liners and you're just like, what? But can we get back to the story? This seems like a waste of our time. It seems as though they liked that sort of thing.
That playfulness with names you brought that up, you know, where the name is itself a pun, does that point to a pretty fundamental aspect to it, that it's a kind of laughing at the mask and what that does and doesn't reveal?
Definitely. I mean, mask is a very interesting question about whether the Roman comedies were masked. Later on, it doesn't appear that they were.
Okay.
Some people think that that should also apply to Plautus and Terence. Most people think that it would be really weird to take over a Greek theatrical tradition and put it into Latin, but not to take over the masks. Particularly, again, so much as you say, the humour derives from how these stock characters are being marshalled, what absurdities are being turned up, what situations they're being put into that are novel. Seeing the sort of the nature in the name that goes back to the earliest points of Greek literature as well. You know, Odysseus's name is not really about trickery, it's more about kind of grief and pain, but you can kind of see how that works.
Yeah.
Some of the suitors have speaking names. They're either, you know, they've either got names that mean kind of like difficult or contrary, or, you know, they're broadly kind of pugnacious. In the Iliad as well, I mean, some of the heroes' names are deeply military.
Yeah.
Or in the case of, for example, like Achilles, people have etymologized Achilles' name to mean sort of like grief of the people.
Interesting.
Achos and Laos.
I was just thinking about Achilles. I was like,
surely Achilles. Yeah.
There must be some sort of.
Yeah, I think there is definitely.
Because obviously
a sense...
in the epithets, you know, the swift footed and all that. But...
There is, I think there is definitely a sense. It can't be an exclusively Greek and Roman thing in early cultures for your name to reflect something about your nature or something about your character. Yeah. I mean, Oedipus is a classic example of, you know, your onoma, your name, reflecting your physis, your nature.
Yeah.
Because Oedipus not only literally means swollen foot, which kind of describes Oedipus's injury from when he was a baby and cast out into the wilderness, but also the first bit of it, the oid bit, means knowledge, which is fundamental to what the Oedipus story is about. When it comes to Plautus, a lot of the names are then... And ancient commentators recognised this, both in Plautus and Terence, that names could be marshalled either to reinforce a characteristic.
Yeah.
So particularly for like the more outlandish stock types like soldiers, for example. The soldier in Plautus's play, the Miles Gloriosus, the swaggery soldier, is called Purga Polynices, which sort of means like the guy who sacks towers in war and causes strife. A lot of it. And his parasite, who
that's
is with
my
him.
Middle name as well, actually. It doesn't fit on my passport.
Yeah. Doesn't roll off the tongue easily. His parasite is called Bread Nibbler, Artotrogus.
Okay.
And the parasite is very candid with the audience in the first scene of the Miles Gloriosus about how cynical he is with regards to the soldier's bravado. And the bravado says, oh, I've killed 20 elephants in one battle. And the parasite's like, yeah, you absolutely destroyed them. And he says to the audience, I mean, this is all bullshit. Like... he's mad,
yeah.
But I just want some food.
It's interesting how that the naming thing gets transmitted into early modern culture, because a lot of early modern allegory is dependent on characters who are, in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Mr. Talkative, Mr. Worldly Wise.
Yes, yeah.
And these characters, they're still kind of part of our stock vocabulary, but literature has to evolve from there.
Yes.
And what happens quite quickly, once you get into the more sophisticated, as we would say it, periods of the history of the novel, you detach itself from these sort of simple allegorical 1-2 relationships. Yeah. There's an element where early modern culture needed to behave like that until it became something else, and it needed to eventually transcend the kind of 1-to-1 name is the thing.
I mean, what's quite interesting is that, like, Plautus's names are so much more outlandish than anything you find in the Greek plays or anything that you find later in Terence. Terence is credited with being closer to the Greek in terms of aesthetic and spirit. And I do sometimes wonder whether a lot of what Plautus is doing with the names is actually drawing out how bonkers a lot of the Greek etymologies are. Maybe not bonkers, but a lot of what Plautus is doing, this is kind of quite a good way of looking at it, is, and this kind of ties into kind of what the Romans found funny, which is that Plautus is taking a Greek product, taking a Greek cultural institution and pulling it apart and showing how it works and showing what is odd about it.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of the Plautus sort of farcical bits, you might just think, why is this here? This doesn't seem to adhere to kind of rules about what makes good writing or good fiction. And a way of looking at it is that it is kind of, if you like, post-comedic. It is kind of a parody of comedy, a parody of Greek comedy. And he's sort of pulling apart what had become quite enshrined. You know, just because the only really prominent surviving author of Greek new comedy is Menander, and even then we barely scratched the surface of what he wrote, there were hundreds of Greek comic playwrights, all working in this closed tradition.
Yeah.
What is so interesting about Plautus is kind of drawing out the mechanics of this tradition and playing with them in sort of plain sight, as it were. You know, what the Romans clearly found funny, to a degree, is Greek culture.
Yeah.
And how they interact with that. The presentation of Greek culture in Plautus is often stereotyped as being this sort of lascivious, louche, luxurious way of living. The Latin word per graecari or con graecari, both words basically meaning to Greek it up, to behave in a thoroughly Greek way. They are used often, and they first occur in Plautus. So they are possibly coinages of his own. But yeah, the Romans clearly found the Greeks a funny nation, but also gained a lot of kind of I suppose, comic irony about how dependent they were on it.
I guess that's the beauty about thinking of the classical world, is just how much you don't know.
Yeah.
And how much you can be a bit creative with it and try and... I love that feeling of saying, well, we don't know about that, but we can draw this conclusion in X, Y, Z reason. I mean, the Romans were clearly very self-conscious about art as art. I mean, their writing is full of questioning what the point is of representing things. You know, how did comedy draw on that sensibility?
The word meta-theatre gets bandied about a lot, particularly in Plautus studies. There's been a bit of a shifting in the sands. I mean, it derives from the work done by a guy called Lionel Arbel in the 60s. And it was mainly about Hamlet initially. It was mainly about the players' scene in Hamlet.
Right.
And how that shines a light on the fact that Hamlet is really a play about finding what role you are playing in your life. Yeah. And the term's undergone a huge, like...
The play is the thing.
Well, exactly, yeah. The term has undergone a great deal of kind of critical undulation. And people sort of vacillate about whether they think it's a helpful term. Is it the same as meta-poetics? Is it the same as meta-literary? If it is, why are we bothering with having a different word? Yeah. Is meta-theatre simply just saying, oh, look, I'm an actor? Or is it something a little bit more sophisticated, which is presenting life as this thing that is already theatricalized? Is it representing life as something where you are playing a role, or you can assume different roles depending on your context?
Yeah, and the Greek models are one of those roles that were available.
Right.
And it was a culture of great power.
Yeah.
And remained a culture of great power, even as the Romans.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Were. So a lot of what may have been popular about Plautus is the way in which he simultaneously allows particularly the enslaved tricksters to kind of flex their performing abilities, to have these characters show their performing abilities, but also to have all of these characters, who, by the way, the settings of the plays are all still Greek. None of the Fabulae Palliatae are set in Rome. There's this critical distance between Rome and the Greek world in which you can do these kind of, I suppose, slightly sillier things, but also things that might rub slightly up against the more conservative mores of the people watching them. There were other plays like the Fabulae Palliatae where, you know, old men would be tricked out of money. They were called the Fabulae Togatae, plays in Roman dress, wearing the toga. But crucially in those, slaves never had the roles that they did in the Palliatae. So it's thought that the sort of fictionalised Greek space of the Palliatae, it was okay to have these slaves being so tricksy and being so meta-theatrical and assuming all of these roles because they were essentially cosplaying, or they were essentially showing how to role-play and showing how funny role-playing can be, even if the role that you're playing is a whole Greek comic tradition.
So is that sort of a game? Like, were there games that were played within the plays?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, game is just one word to describe, I suppose, what you would classify as, like, what the premise of a bit is, or what the what the overarching joke of a bit is.
Yeah, because you kind of have to reconstruct, I guess, some kind of vocabulary to describe.
Yeah, definitely. And that's not to say that the Romans didn't start to develop this kind of vocabulary themselves. I mean, what I was saying about komoidiai being in Latin, I misspoke earlier, it definitely does occur in Greek to describe the comedies that are on. But Latin starts to...
I love that. Our listeners will have gone away.
They would have gone and checked the Aristophanic Parabases and found, oh, but it's mentioned there, Orlando, in line 627.
I trust our listeners to have done that, actually.
And so you should. Good on them. But crucially, in Latin, you know, a vocabulary to start sort of discussing comedic poetics starts to evolve. I mean, I mentioned desis and lusis in Greek, but for example, one of the prominent uses of komoidia in Plautus is also used alongside this word frustratio, which is used, and this happens in the Mostellaria, at the very end of it, where a slave essentially says to the old man that he's tricked, you should tell other Greek comic playwrights about the frustrationes that I've played on you today.
Okay.
Means tricks in the sense of, like, you know, like delaying someone.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of emerging critical vocabulary emerging. In terms of game, I suppose it's a helpful way of thinking about it because so much of what is fun and funny about these plays is this idea of play, is this idea of the ludic. And indeed, you know, ludi, the Latin word for schools, but also the Latin word for festivals and games. Ludi is the word that describes the festivals that these plays are put on in.
Yeah.
Albeit not quite on the same scale as the Dionysiac festivals of the Athenian tradition. But ludi is also the word that ends up being used for kind of the tricks that are used in the plays. Ludos facere means to play a trick on someone. In terms of what games are, the various kind of, I suppose, comedy practitioners, you know, people who do improv and that kind of thing, define game as basically a comedic pattern of behaviour that repeats and that is kind of mechanical. And that you can take as a kind of nugget of a premise or whatever and just put in different situations in order to highlight the incongruity with that situation or to highlight the kind of robotic doggedness of that. And I suppose the laugh is just the emotional response to seeing that imbalance in the way that things are.
So have you got any real examples from the comedies themselves that you can illustrate for us?
There's, the most obvious example is from Plotters to Play the Rope.
Good title.
It is a good title, yeah. A lot of these things are quite baggy and outstay their welcome. And so a lot of their subject matter, you're kind of just like, I mean, I guess, guys, okay, you're a pre-modern society. You can laugh at this stuff if you like. This one, you know, is pretty, I suppose, is closer aligned to what you might be able to get away with putting on now.
Okay.
But the gamiest bit of this, I suppose, the kind of most sort of robotic and repetitive bit of behaviour is a bit where a sort of nicer older guy called Daimoness, it's towards the end of the play, the kind of the problem of the play about the identity of two sex workers actually being freeborn has been kind of solved. And they're just deciding that there's like a marriage being put on inside, and this old man comes out to give instructions to the slave of the groom, who's called Tracalio. And the context isn't really that important. What's more important is this idea of repetition being something that people might find funny.
Yeah,
basically. And it's a very famous bit. It's just called the Liquet bit. And it's kind of what we would Liquet is just the Latin word for it is possible or okay, basically. But you can kind of read it as an ancestor of sort of commedia dell'arte routines, so-called lazzi. The idea being that there are certain sketches or like bits that you can just insert into something, and if it's funny enough, it doesn't matter that it detracts from the story. So Daimoness comes out, and he comes out and is speaking back into the house to his wife. And he says, initially, you know, you'd better put a stop to your kissing at some point, my wife, and get ready so that I can sacrifice to the household gods when I come in, because they've increased our household. So this is just kind of like exposition, I suppose. We have unblemished lambs and pigs ready. So this is for the kind of the sacrifice and the wedding bit. And then he sees Tracalio and he says, but why are you delaying Tracalio? Oh, no, he hasn't seen Tracalio yet. Sorry. He speaks to himself, you know, where is Tracalio? Why are you delaying? Oh, there he is. He's coming out. And then Tracalio, the slave, says, wherever he is, I'll find Plesidippus, who's his master, now, and I'll bring him to you along with me. Daimoness says, tell him how all this has happened about my daughter. Ask him to leave everything else aside and to come here. Tracalio goes, okay. Say that I'll give him my daughter in marriage. Okay. And I know that his father and that he's my relative. Okay. But be quick. Okay. But make sure that he is here instantly so that dinner can be seen to. Okay. Okay to everything. Okay. But do you know what I want from you? To remember what you promised me so that I'm free today. This is Tracalio saying this. And then Daimoness takes over the okay thing and goes, okay. And Tracalio, make sure that you persuade Plesidippus to set me free. Okay. And have your daughter ask him. She'll easily persuade him. Okay. And have Ampeliska marry me when I'm free. Okay. And have me find my good turn repaid by your actions. Okay. Okay to everything. Okay. I'm paying you back on your own coin. But be quick to go to the city at once and return here again. Tracalio goes, okay. I'll be back in a moment. So, like, it's...
Sorry.
It is really dumb.
I think you should put this on as a one-man... as a one-man performance at, like, Soho Theatre in 6 months' time. The Rope as interpreted.
I wonder if...
One-man shows are all the rage now.
They are... Yeah. I don't think the Soho would look at my one-man Plautus, and that's on them. That's a real... They should think about that.
But I guess the repeating thing is what children do. Children find that really funny.
It kind of plays into the sort of playfulness aspect of
I'm
it.
Trying to think of the things you used to do at school. Saying why. If someone
annoying thing. Yeah. That's the most like obvious example. Obviously, it's not like, to our standards, it's not brilliant. But like...
it needs a bit of workshopping, yeah.
I'm not doing it justice because it's too complicated to like...
I kind of mean about there's even something like Rabelais, which is like comparably much closer to us in cultural terms. You still do need to do a lot of legwork. You need to think about the kinds of social roles.
Yeah,
he thinks you need to think about like what making a monk ridiculous would actually mean to a Renaissance person or whatever, or what Renaissance people believed about astrology, which is a big theme in Rabelais. It's like you have to think a little bit through that.
Yes.
And once you do that work, it does become amusing, but I wouldn't say laugh.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, another example of this sort of like robotic behaviour is, you know, you get a lot of the, should we say, comic hero characters. When I say that, characters who are not necessarily yeah. obstacles to the progression of comic action. They're not grouches, basically.
Yeah.
You get the trickster characters having this sort of verbal fun. What was interesting about that is that it flips and the old man gets it eventually. But with the old man doing the okays, it's a lot more frustrated. Mm. Whereas with the trickster doing it, it's not frustrated. You can contrast that robotic behaviour with characters who are often characterised as being kind of obstacles to comic action. In the Pseudolus, there's a bit where the kind of baddie of the Pseudolus is this sort of pantomime-esque villain yeah. who's a pimp called Balio. And there is a bit where Pseudolus, the clever slave, and his young owner, Calidorus, who is trying to secure exclusive rights to a sex worker he's fallen in love with from this pimp. Calidorus has been duped by the pimp, and basically the Phoenician, the courtesan in question, is being sold against Calidorus' wishes and everything. And what I was saying about kind of routines yeah. and comic things can kind of be inserted that are possibly irrelevant to the plot. The routine of the flagitatio is involved here. The flagitatio is essentially a mudslinging
right.
passage where people just insult people. Okay. And supposedly this derives from instances in real life, so-called Italian folk justice, where someone might be late on a payment or someone might have done something wrong to your daughter or something, and you would go and find them in the street and just pelt them with insults and pelt them with shouting. A routine such as that is inserted here, where Pseudolus and his young master Calidorus just pelt the pimp with insults. Mm. And what would be interesting about this is kind of what doesn't really read for us. We can kind of get a sense of it. You know, when people get pelted with insults, usually they're ashamed. What the flip here is that the pimp actually embraces all of them. And so they start calling him, you know, a piece of shit and everything. He just goes, oh, indeed, you know. And they're like, you know, they say like, you know, Calidora says, open fire, Pseudolus. My insults will rupture him. You outrageous monster, Balio, oh, indeed. Calidorus, douchebag, Balio, right the first time and the second time. He's said douchebag earlier on the scene. Pseudolus, scumbag, Balio, why not? Calidorus, grave robber, Balio, guilty as charged. So it's like that sort of embracing of the, like this robotic embracing of insults. Again, it's kind of funny to us. It's kind of amusing. Mm. But what would make it more funny to a Roman audience is the fact that to be abused like this, that would resonate with them as something of a deeply shameful experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if we're abused in the street, if someone, you know, calls you a scumbag in the street, you wouldn't see it as like a real... Well, I suppose if it's by a stranger, you definitely wouldn't see it as like an insult to your honour. But even if you were called a scumbag by someone that you'd like done wrong, you probably wouldn't be as ashamed of it. Mainly because people in the public might not know what you've done and they might not know you.
I mean, it's like choose a completely an example at the other end of the emotional scale, but crucifixion, the kind of nature of crucifixion in the Roman world.
Which, by the way, they also found funny.
Really? Well,
as in there were jokes about crucifixion in Plautus.
But yeah, exactly. But crucifixion, to get your head into the mentality of the early Christian, you have to have some idea of what crucifixion actually meant, what being a slave actually meant,
the
power of going into that social status for someone who claimed to be the Godhead. It's something you have to think your way through. It was something of enormous cultural potency, what happened. And I guess we kind of talked a little bit about the classical world. You yourself are appearing in the West End in the next few weeks. Tell me a bit about that and tell me a bit about how it's made you think about putting stuff on in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very fortunate to be joining the cast of the Back to the Future musical. And what's been really interesting about it, aside from how just impressive everyone is up close, you know, when you go and see these things, you appreciate the level of skill involved. Obviously, it's part of, you know, that it's part of the experience. But to see all of the acting and singing and dancing up close in rehearsals is really amazing. And, you know, it's never been more of a delight to feel out of my depth. But what is really interesting about it is that it is an adaptation of something that already exists, right? So it is striving to do something new and innovative within very constricted bounds. It is as good an analogue for what the Romans are doing with Roman comedy as any. Not least because a lot of what Plautus is kind of credited with in terms of what he does with Greek comedy, I talked about how he's kind of pulling it apart and showing us all how it works. But another thing that Plautus does that is really innovative, that the Greek material doesn't really have to the same extent, is the sort of musicalization of it.
Right.
Plautus's plays are metrically incredibly dense and incredibly complex. And it's completely lost to us what it would have sounded like musically.
Yeah.
You can guess, based on what the meter is, but melodically, harmonically, impossible to tell. But what's really obvious is that there is a great deal more investment in how these things are being executed musically. And it may be that what the Romans maybe not found funny, but maybe took great delight in, is this idea of something that they already knew to have cultural capital being reinvented for their own moment and for, like, their own tastes. So what's very interesting about being in something like the Back to the Future musical is that it's very obvious where things have been expanded so that there can be a song there. It is literally a musicalization of it. You know, there is some music in the film, yeah, but it's not tied to the plot. I'm not sure if anyone's ever written anything about to what degree Plautine's song escalates plot, because so much of Plautus is, you see how, like in Hamilton, for example, or Les Mis, like a lot of the plot has underscore or indeed is, yeah, sung through.
Yeah.
The sort of unmarked meter of Plautus is called the trochaic tetrameter catalectic or the trochaic septenarius, and that is the most common meter, so it doesn't really have the same effect as the more lyrical song bits that use all kinds of meters. And what I'm saying is that no one's done any work on it, I think about how much those like lyrical passages escalate the plot.
These questions are not that esoteric, though, because actually what you think about the role of the chorus in,
right,
Greek,
yeah,
in Greek tragedy or all these things has made or broken the careers of some of our most brilliant thinkers and philosophers. Nietzsche had very strong views about what the function of the chorus was, yeah, in Greek tragedy, and it inspired the birth of tragedy, which kind of set him on his road to being this kind of great philosopher. And I guess what I often kind of always want to emphasize on this podcast about the classical world and thinking about the classical world is that we don't know a lot, and that means we have big arguments about what we do know. But because people have thought that that has mattered for a long time,
yeah,
what we think about the classical world,
yeah,
that has affected our own society,
yeah,
in myriad and weird ways.
Yes,
actually.
I suppose it's kind of like, it's small beer whether Plautus actually matters or not. He matters in the sense of it's interesting to trace like the history, yeah, of comedy, but you know, to take the chorus for example, there's no choruses,
right. Yeah.
That's one of the biggest changes that Plautus makes, is that he takes away the chorus from the Greek New Comedies. And it should just be said as well that the chorus in the Greek New Comedies has ceased to have, as far as we understand it, has ceased to have the most intimate direct relevance to the plot as they do in Greek tragedy, for example. So in Greek tragedy, the choruses are, you know, old men or they're old women who are like taking part in the story. They may not have a direct or as impactful a narrative energy to them, but they do react to what's going on stage. Whereas it's thought that the Greek chorus in Menander, for example, is usually going to be some kind of song that may or may not have had broad thematic relevance to maybe the issues of the play, but definitely didn't have the same. One of the reasons why this is thought is that the text for these chorus bits in Menander don't survive.
Right.
In manuscripts, you see Greek, Greek, Greek of the dialogue, and then it just says choru. And that just means there's a song of the chorus here that we don't have. But yeah, I think it's definitely been a bit of a swerve going from doing doctoral research on Roman comedy to being in a West End musical. And yeah, I'm very grateful for,
yeah,
all those who have been involved in getting me there. Again, and it's probably very pretentious of me to say, well, you know, my experience in looking at Plautus is actually fundamental to my appreciation of Back to the Future, the musical. Not least because it seems very unfair to expect that as a qualification to be in a West End musical. But yeah, I suppose, you know, going back to the kind of universality, maybe not of the how funny it is, Plautus, the Back to the Future musical is very funny, but the maybe not necessarily about how funny these things are, but just what's universal about the process of adapting something, yeah, has actually been very interesting.
Yeah, and I think the classical worlds, again, just to sort of speak in defence of thinking about this stuff, because again, it can seem a bit esoteric. There's not a single great modern artwork, I think, that doesn't include actually a pretty strong, mostly self-conscious set of references to the classical world. Or
definitely
types that have been transmitted through European culture.
Yeah, definitely.
Things like The Wires, full of Iliadic references. Platoon, my colleague Paul Lay, senior editor of Engels World, we did a podcast on the Iliad where we talked about where the Iliad pops up,
yeah,
in modern culture. Platoon is the classic Iliadic theme of the best soldier against the moral soldier who wants to defend what they have. You know, these kinds of contests do resonate. I guess what I wanted to finish on was, how has Roman comedy been adapted in the last 100 years, specifically? Because there are a few, there's a couple of people who've tried to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, you've had things like Up Pompeii, which it seems to be pretty successful. I've only seen bits of it. I've not seen the whole range of it. But it uses very much the similar techniques of very intimate audience address. The person who's in control of narrating the play, which in and of itself is an interesting dramaturgical device, that person is usually also... One, the person with the most audience rapport, and the reason they've got that is because they're also the person pulling the strings in the story as well. Kind of what I was saying about, you know, meta theatre and sort of role playing and shifting what your mask is.
And I guess something like Life of Brian probably is in some glimmering way relating to the fact that the Romans did do amusing things, even though in that great, very funny bit, what the Romans done for us, they don't say the Romans invented being funny.
That is true. And actually, what's very interesting about these plays is that because they are all nominally set in a Greek space, there are these moments where the Roman world does intrude on them. The references to crucifixion, for example, are a good example of that. But other things as well, systems of coinage, it's kind of a bit muddy about exactly what the financial system is. It's more Greek than Roman, but there are moments where you're like, that feels like a Roman thing. Suddenly, a lot of the kind of the legal world of these plays has these moments where you're just like, but that doesn't happen in Greek law, that only happens in Roman law. They usually have to do with things like paying deposits on houses and things like that. Contracts of sale of anything, in fact, appear to have as Roman a bent as they would a Greek one. And usually what that's credited with is Plautus kind of being a bit fast and loose. He doesn't really care. It's not important to him that it makes sense in an internal logic scale. But in terms of how important is Roman comedy to modern comedy, you know, there's everything to say that David Brent is a sort of swaggering soldier. Maybe not very military, but he's got the kind of self-belief that is always undercut. The parasite, Gareth, is a parasite. That's just what it, and Dwight Schrute, that is the archetypal parasite. If you look at...
And that meta-theatrical thing, the office itself is a metaphor for British society at the time. You talk about how we find, I guess, some of those direct, kind of incredibly chauvinistic narratives we find less funny. But still, in The Office, they're exploring the 90s are an odd time. Across, people are grappling with what was called political correctness in the 90s. There are lots of jokes about like chauvinism. And you know, and there's that social division between the people who work in the warehouse and in The Office. You have characters like Tim who will, in a cowardly way, almost laugh along sometimes to the or see the kind of funny side, but then will themselves sort of be quite critical. And then I guess that, if we're going to say there are universal things about comedy, it's getting into particular spaces and almost like prodding at the limits of them and seeing where it snaps back and where there is the reversal and where there then is the comic space, I guess, to play with it.
The two things that I should also include about that is that, one, an added complexity to this is that all of the women in Roman comedy are played by men. But that's not to say that the female characters in their own right don't get to have their moments to say stuff truthfully. There's sort of this oddly moving bit in one of the plays called The Merchant, where an older enslaved woman, who's called Syra, which kind of suggests that she might be from, at the very least, Syria, if not, you know, broadly speaking, the Eastern world, quote unquote. You know, she has this sort of oddly stirring, but also kind of quite satirical monologue where she just enumerates how difficult it is to be a woman right now. She's like, God, I wish it looks so much easier to be a bloke. Equally, you know, there are a lot of the sex workers in Plautus are deeply charismatic figures who completely run rings around the men that they're tricking. The truculentus, a word that just sort of means truculent, you know, sort of rough and kind of a bit prickly, which is about a character called Truculentus who is a slave. But the hero of the Truculentus is the sex worker Phrynisium, or Phronisium, depending on which manuscript variant you're kind of buying into. And she's thought to be, you know, Plautus's sort of arch, tricksy sex worker who has kind of real historical precedent in figures like Neaira and Aspasia in 5th and 4th century Athens. So, you know, for every discussion there is about kind of the sexual politics of things like this, there are always these figures who defy that norm.
And I guess that's very interesting. It's, again, we often talked about it on this podcast about how in when you start looking at the classical world, I know it's a cliche, but it's true, like the best cliches, there is not an argument for and against the stuff that we talk about that you will not find in a classical source. There is an anti-slavery argument made as powerfully as a pro-slavery argument. There is an anti-democratic argument made as powerfully as, you know, the arguments for democracy. So, you know, it's a kind of very rich series of texts to read the world through. I think we've covered a huge amount of ground there. I'm not sure we have actually established what the Romans necessarily laughed at, but they must have laughed. Everyone laughs, I guess. It's a kind of basic human function.
And I think if people want answers, or at least a broader coverage, they could do a lot worse than looking at Mary Beard's book about laughter in the Roman world.
Okay.
2014, I think it's Berkeley that it's published by.
Okay, great.
And it's a really good book. Well, and it answers a lot more and in much better sentences what I've said.
We should do, like, in our time, we should start having reading lists.
So that's
a good start.
Is it called Laughter in the Roman World or Laughter and the Roman World? It's something like that.
We'll let our listeners work that one out. Well, thanks, Orlando. That was fantastic. Thanks for coming on. And good luck for your run the West End.
Thank you very much.